I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Although smart growth makes financial and environmental sense for communities, it's not always easy to achieve. Paul Krutko is attempting to remake San Jose in the heart of Silicon Valley with smart growth from his Office of Economic Development. His efforts come at the insistence of Valley Company CEOs who say their employees' time is too valuable to be spent in traffic. Benjamin Della Pena and Bill Fulton are collaborating to provide tools for communities to use to figure out step by step how they achieve smart growth. We'll talk about smart growth and how to make it happen this week on Smart City, but first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Paul Krutko is director of the Office of Economic Development for San Jose, the city that calls itself the capital of Silicon Valley. Paul is also responsible for the city's Office of Cultural Affairs. Paul previously led the Jacksonville, Florida Downtown Development Authority and held a number of development positions at the city of Cleveland.
Paul, you've worked in Cleveland and now you're in San Jose in Silicon Valley. How does working in a new economy city like San Jose differ from working in what most would call an old economy city like Cleveland?
Well, I think it's the pace and speed of development that is substantively different. We talk about Silicon Valley time, and that means that the new economy companies tend to think about bringing ideas, products, processes to the market in days and weeks. And the challenge for government, in terms of how it interacts with businesses, many times thinks not in months, but maybe even years and decades in terms of policy formation. So the big challenge is to try to move a governmental organization in a way that can be responsive to the needs of those companies.
What do technology companies, like the ones you have headquartered in San Jose, eBay, Adobe, want from local government other than to move quickly?
Well, I think part of our approach is to recognize that while many people around the country, as they talk about their economic development program, they speak to the notion of government creating jobs, our notion here is that government really isn't the engine for creating jobs. In fact, we tend to be more of a brake on job creation by the way we approach our interaction with companies. So we've created special kinds of responses to those needs. Time is the old adage, time is money, is very true here. And so a number of programs we put in place, I'll give you two examples. One is a program called our Special Tenant Improvement Program, in which we respond to the needs of new emerging companies by assembling the team that would be reviewing their proposal from a variety of city departments, bring them into a room, have the company interact, and get their approvals done in a day, as opposed to the more traditional process in which a company, an executive who isn't a real estate professional, isn't someone who knows how to get a permit generally, goes from office to office and may end up in a do loop where he has to return to the first office because of what he heard in the fourth office. So we've put that program together. It's had great success. It's caused us to be able to move companies into millions of square feet of new occupancy here in San Jose. And that's the point I should make. As I talk with my colleagues around the country, we do operate at a scale that, as you relate to my experience in Cleveland, that is substantively different than what you find in most municipalities. And so that's one approach. The second approach is a program we call our Industrial Tools Program, in which we actually pre-approve the use of a variety of equipment in a facility ahead of time that allows the company to put that equipment and those processes in place without having to wait for approvals each time they install a new component within their production system. We found great responsiveness to that from our companies, as seeing that as a very, very meaningful and responsive to their needs.
Are technology companies more or less interested in issues of quality of life than companies in other industries?
I actually think that they are more interested in it than my experience. As you mentioned, I worked in Cleveland, and I spent 6 years in Jacksonville, Florida, doing much the same work, and then here in San Jose and Silicon Valley. And what we see is very true and very important in moving forward is that we are in a worldwide competition for talent. And talent is a lot different than buildings and machinery and equipment and whether you have access to rail or airports or anything like that. Talent today in the innovative driving industry economies is incredibly mobile, has significant choices in terms of what they can do, but more than that, where they can live. And as a result, you see that innovative cities, using your terminology, smart cities, are responding to the need to be attractive to the talent, not just to the companies. Companies tend to follow today in the innovative economy where the talent is. And what's important, I think, in our case, as we position ourselves in a global competition, is an incredibly diverse and open and very embracing culture that is unique, we think, as we look around the world. You talk to many of the executives, and they will tell you that they met someone from a completely different part of the world here, can work on an idea together, establish a global business platform, working with individuals from all over the world, and be successful. If you think about sort of the strife that we have all over the world between ethnic cultures and different races and religions and creeds, the opportunity that Silicon Valley represents as a model of how people can interact to better society has been really something interesting for me to observe since I've been here.
Mm-hmm. Are those the new qualities of life that companies are seeking, open, embracing, tolerant?
I believe so. I had an opportunity to give a speech recently in Dublin, Ireland to a conference that was sponsored by Dublin, but was an EU initiative on what they were calling knowledge cities, and they were trying to explore this very point. And many of them admitted, this was a group that included Tallinn, Barcelona, Dublin, many of them admitted that the issue for them was the question of tolerance and diversity, and was a particular challenge for them, considering this global transitioning of talent to be incredibly mobile and focusing on things more than the job, because the job can be connected to in a variety of ways. So yes, and so in our overall package here, we do spend a great deal of time in terms of cultural development. Our Office of Economic Development lead actually has incorporated our whole cultural program as a part of our economic development effort. So we've put that together. We see the development of arts, culture, in particular, we've got a particular focus on the digital art as a sort of a platform for us that's very important to that quality of life and attraction question.
How does government, Paul, encourage cultural development that leads to an open, embracing, tolerant place?
That's a very good question, Carol. I think the key point is that you need to create, and it's a challenge we're having right now, because when you have a community, we're nearly a million in population in the city proper now. We're a third Asian of a variety of nationalities and cultures, a third Hispanic, and about a third Anglo, a small percentage of African-American population. You have communities who want a lot of different types of cultural and art programs. And so one of the challenges for cities is, how do you support that? How do you nurture that? And what we try to do is use resources. We have set aside a very significant amount of money from our head tax on hotel occupancy to support art and cultural development. We have a very engaged arts community in terms of a commission that reviews the funding for a variety of proposals. And we really truly try to help those organizations on the business side of their operations. Where we find difficulty many times is arts and cultural organizations aren't really strong in terms of how to run that organization as a business. So we spend a lot of time on that to grow them and nurture them in a way that they can be self-sustaining and reach various populations in our community.
Do you specifically, Paul, evaluate arts and cultural organizations that you will support as government on the basis of their ability to encourage and amplify this open, embracing, tolerant culture you say is so fundamental to new economy businesses?
Yes, I think the example that I would give you is that we felt very strongly that a place that was a art and cultural area that we wanted to be at the forefront was really the whole issue of the digital technologies as a new media for art. And so we took an aggressive leadership position and actually fashioned a new biannual festival, sort of modeled after the Venice Biennale, but in that space. And so we our initial festival was held in 2006. We will be holding it again in 2008, and it is a by invitation curated type of festival that is seeking artists from all over the world who would actually use the streets of San Jose as their media, using cell phones, using digital technologies of a variety of sources. And the notion with that is that we connect fully to all of the cultures in our community and cultures around the world, positioning ourselves as a place where, from a tolerance point of view, we are very much embracing of new forms of art, new ways of expression that uses the technologies that have come to the forefront in the last several decades as the paintbrush, if you will, of the 21st century. So I think that's an example of where we put forward some initial seed money, put forward significant staff time to organize that, and now that's been embraced by major foundations in this area, by leading corporations, as something that they want to participate in. And for example, with Cisco, they are actually in this year's festival looking at how they can use their telepresence technology to actually connect to the communities where they have now placed operations around the world, to have them actually have a real-time physical link to the festival and actually create content in those locations that can be shared across that sort of platform. So that's an example of how we try to engage our technology companies in a way that's reflective of what they do, but also creating a very tolerant, diverse environment in the arts space.
Yeah. You know, it strikes me as you talk, Paul, how different the thinking is in San Jose when it comes to arts and cultural investments, versus, again, an older, more traditional community with more traditional arts investments. You know, even the international links you describe, I think, would not come naturally to a lot of communities. And so it's interesting to hear you talk about that aspect of what you're doing in San Jose and how you're making that really fundamental to the investments that you are making in the arts. And I think also interesting is that you're not trying to duplicate what older communities, more traditional communities have done in the arts, but you are, in fact, making your own path. I'm really curious, we've talked about, again, culture as quality of life, open, tolerant, embracing, and how that makes it possible to do business in the new economy, in the innovative economy, as you describe it. Are there physical manifestations of quality of life that you are striving to deliver in response to what companies want in Silicon Valley and in San Jose.
Yeah, so I think that a good example of that is a major policy initiative that we engaged in the area of North San Jose. It was called North San Jose along a boulevard called North First Street, which is a known technology address around the world. That is the principal companies that are located on that. Boulevard are Cisco Systems that has its headquarters at that location, some 20,000 employees. eBay has a location. And in fact, I think we have some stats that say we basically have one half of all of the technology companies in the world have some form of headquarters in and around that location. From a physical point of view, the companies, we engaged in an economic development strategy formation about 4 years ago. We never had one here as a city. The notion was that the economy was so great, the purpose of government was to regulate and charge fees sort of benefit from the development. But when the recession hit, when the bubble burst, we lost one out of every 10 jobs in the United States in the last recession. It was incredibly devastating. I think it was well covered in the national media. That was sort of a wake-up call about what we should do to focus on and what was important. So we reached out and talked with the corporations, and they really laid out the notion that this is a very high cost location, but a very high return on location for them, and that they were willing to pay very high salaries to bring people to this location, but they had to have environments that were conducive to their ability to be productive. And one of the things that's changed in a physical form in that North San Jose area is I sometimes speak to it as a back to the future approach. The companies are very much going away from the traditional, or want us and asked us to change our land use policies to go away from the traditional what we think is the technology park form.
What is your comeback when someone says, well, you know, look, Paul, I mean, you can change San Jose and the physical layout and build up a downtown and build smarts and culture, but you are attracting all these talented people before you had all of that. Why do you need to add it now? Why invest in that? Does it really attract talent?
Well, I think the issue really right now is that the how incredibly mobile the talent is, and what we're actually finding is Annalise Sexanian has wrote this book, I forget the full title, but it's The Global Argonauts. If you're a world citizen, you're not going to put up with the opportunity not to have a high quality, high-rise residential place to live and quality cultural amenities and those kinds of things. So it is part of the competition. We've kind of embraced as a talking point. And I did this in Dublin, that Richard Flores' recent work is this notion that the world is spiky. That the joint venture did a report that, sort of independent of that, but playing off that a little bit, they looked at the main innovative centers around the world and looked at the flows between them, the capital flows, the knowledge flows, and the accretion of talent. So the point, I guess, is that I always say to people here, because I didn't grow up in the 3-4 decades of this technology innovation juggernaut, that the future isn't foreordained. I mean, my story always goes back to Cleveland. From 1950 to 1980, lost 500,000 people in population. But what was the new economy in the 40s? It was cars, steel, and airplanes, right? So nobody who is in the Valley today has to be in the Valley to be able to, on the big players. I think what's interesting to see now is the notion that lots of companies from around the world feel they have to have some foothold here to get in the milieu of the interchange and innovative culture. We had 10 companies from Finland show up and decide this was, they needed to create, space for themselves here. because they couldn't do that from Oulu, Finland. And so, but nonetheless, if John Chambers tomorrow said, you know, we want to move Cisco, there is no real reason for Cisco to be here or for HP to be here for anybody. It's like Boeing in Chicago, right? So you have to kind of work on this soft stuff. And I find when I go to my other main professional organization beyond yours, which I really enjoy being involved in, is the International Economic Development Council. And so when I talk there, you've got a lot of folks that just don't get, economic development professionals just don't get that the soft side of this, the quality of life issues are what are driving companies. It's not the incentive.
Paul Krutko is director of the Office of Economic Development for the City of San Jose. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor Nate Berg.
You probably can tell when you're in a walkable area. There's lots of shops, safe sidewalking space, and, well, people walking. But besides simply having those evident characteristics, what really makes a city walkable? Streets Blog recently reported an analysis of census data that shed some light on the walkability of places. Using a database put together by a bike delivery service in Iowa called Bikes at Work Incorporated, Streets Blog looked at the places with the highest percentages of people who walk to work. What they found was that almost all of the places that ranked the highest were centered around some sort of an institution, like a university or a military site. These places tend to have high populations of residents living near the institutions who also walk there. So it could be argued that having a college or a military academy makes a place walkable, technically. But it also should be argued that urban design plays a comparable, if not more important, role in getting feet on the street. Meanwhile, more and more cities across the U.S. are instituting programs that essentially kill two birds with one stone. Or maybe more appropriately, plant two seeds with one shovel, by creating environmental cleanup and activism jobs that do the double duty of greening the city and fueling the economy by providing jobs. USA Today reports that cities like Richmond, California, Chicago, Illinois, and the Bronx in New York have created programs that train unemployed people to perform tasks such as solar panel installation, ecological restoration, and hazardous waste cleanup. These cities have been able to create these opportunities by forming partnerships with employers and nonprofits and are receiving extra support from two recently passed congressional bills that earmark more than $2 billion for city greening efforts like these job training programs. As more cities pick up on the trend, they are rapidly creating a new niche in the nation's workforce that has been dubbed the green-collar job. And finally, plans to convert a sizable section of Pennsylvania's Interstate 80 into a toll road were dealt a serious setback recently from the Federal Highway Administration. The Philadelphia Inquirer reports that the administration returned the state's application to convert the 311-mile section of highway into a toll road, questioning why the state thinks the conversion is even necessary. Pennsylvania was applying to be one of three states allowed to place tolls on interstate highways as a way to boost the state's transportation coffers. They wanted to use the revenues to fund road building, bridge repairs, and improvements to public transportation systems. The Federal Highway Administration, however, requires that all funds generated by tolls be used to fund improvements to the road being tolled. With this setback, many politicians are suggesting the state revisit the option of leasing the road, leaving the task of dealing with the governmental red tape in the hands of a private firm. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll find out about the new toolkit that can help you achieve smart growth in your community. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Benjamin Della Pena is the Smart Growth Leadership Institute's Associate Director for Implementation. William Fulton is Senior Research Fellow at the University of Southern California. Together, they have developed the Smart Growth Implementation Toolkit. Benjamin, how do you define smart growth?
Smart growth is basically an alternative way to grow. It's a better way to grow. It's getting communities to have the benefits of growth, more jobs, affordable housing, without the pain of unplanned growth or short-sighted planning. The quick way to talk about it, it's not sprawl is the quick way to talk about it, but it's so much more than that. It really is about sustainable urban and municipal development.
And is it easy for an ordinary citizen to know it when she sees it?
Definitely. You can walk through a community and understand whether it is smart growth or it's not.
And what are the signs one should be looking for?
Walkability, first of all, a variety of transportation options. There are 10 principles that define smart growth. And on top of that is a variety of transportation choices. If the community you're in gives you no other choice but to drive somewhere to get anything, to go to school, to go to work, to pick up a gallon of milk from the store. If you have to drive to do that, then you're probably not living in a community that is very sustainable as of the moment. Mixing land uses is the other big thing. When you can see stores on the ground floor and residences on top, or schools next to housing, or businesses right next to where people live, shop, and play. A range of housing opportunities is the other thing, that it's not just one particular type of housing, that it's not all the same size, that there are options for families who are starting out and options for singles who would like to live in town, and options for aging seniors who are not yet quite ready to be in the cared-for home but want to live closer to where they can walk to places, to the restaurant, or to see their friends.
You've used the term walkability. One of the 10 principles of smart growth, as you say, is creating walkable neighborhoods. But how do you judge walkability? Is there a simple way to do it?
It's a quarter mile is the standard measure, right? If you can walk to something within a quarter mile, it's the mix of land uses. If, again, I go back to my earlier answer, if for every the chores you have to do every day, if it requires that you have to be in a car for most of it, then it's not a walkable community. If, for instance, you decide, I want to pick up something from the hardware store or from the grocery, and it takes me about 5 to 10 minutes, even 15 minutes to walk there, and I can do that, then it's a walkable community. Apart from the fact that there are sidewalks, that there are places to walk to.
Mm-hmm. How do you reconcile the ever larger retail formats where we seem to be contending with, and this need to have everyday chores within a quarter mile distance from one's home?
Reconcile by why does it happen?
Well, reconcile by if retailers are getting ever larger, and yet what you really want is ever smaller retail formats to fit within that quarter mile walking distance. How do you make sure the two? I mean, how do you get one when the other is the pattern?
What's interesting is the big box retailers are also changing their patterns. I mean, in Manhattan, there's a Home Depot that sits on three stories. And I understand Walmart is starting to experiment with the pattern too, mainly because their Asian markets will not have this kind of large footprints that they can find. They need to be where most of the density is. For in the U.S., the what we need to reconcile is the fact that the demographic changes that are happening, and I think you've covered this extensively in your show, is that the preferences are changing. People want to be in walkable communities, and so therefore the stores will have to follow where the market is.
If I can add something about retail, retail's not only getting bigger, it's also getting smaller. I think there's no question that many consumers will always drive to very large retail to buy some things. But more and more people want to be able to buy many of their everyday things very, very easily. Traffic congestion is worse than ever. So, for example, we see larger and larger supermarket floor plates. But at the same time, we see a proliferation of, for example, small specialty grocery store models through Trader Joe's and Whole Foods and Tesco. So I don't think it's all in one direction. There, clearly, we're going to see bigger and bigger stores for some things, discount shopping especially. But we're also seeing more and more smaller stores designed to fit both the demographic changes Benji talked about and also a more walkable community.
Bill, do you find that public officials and developers are adopting the language of smart growth without adopting the reality of smart growth?
Very often that is the case. And this is kind of an amusing thing because if you talk to people who claim that smart growth isn't very realistic, they'll say there's not the market for it, either the political appetite for it or in the marketplace. And yet increasingly you find politicians and developers and builders adopting the rhetoric and not always adopting the reality. That suggests that there's a market there for it, even when people don't quite adopt the reality. A lot of it we found in our work, Benji and I have found that politicians in particular see the rhetorical value. They want to put the policies in place. But very often either they or the developers or the technicians who work for the politicians are reluctant to let go of a lot of the longstanding code standards, such as parking standards or street width. When Benji was talking about walkability and a 5 or 10 minute walk, you know, that would be obliterated if you have to cross an 8-lane street. So we've spent a lot of time working with communities to try to make sure that their codes and the other day-to-day decisions they make actually line up with their policies and their rhetoric.
And part of the way you're trying to make this more accessible and more routine is that you've developed what you call the Smart Growth Implementation Toolkit. Tell me about it.
Well, the toolkit is a set of tools, basically, that we've developed over a 4-year period. It was through a project that was funded by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. And it was basically that there are lots of communities that said they want smart growth, but there are regulatory barriers to it. And in many of the places we worked with, there were high and lofty language in the policies about wanting to grow smarter, wanting more sustainable development. But if you went down to the nitty-gritty of the codes and the zoning, there were provisions that were preventing them from getting to more walkable communities, to providing more options in housing and transportation. So it's a set of tools, basically. The big ones are the audits of policy, codes and zoning, and the other one is a project scorecard that looks at development that's coming through or coming to a community and measuring them against the principles of smart growth. The audit tools looks at the regulatory instruments, the policy, land use, comprehensive planning, long-range land use plan, and looks at the codes and zoning like subdivision regulations and tries to see whether they fit into the principles of smart growth, whether they are meeting the community's vision for smarter growth.
And you said that there are, even if you're talking the language of smart growth, if you get into the details of codes and zoning, you'll find provisions that become barriers to the realization of smart growth. What are the most common barriers to smart growth?
Let's take zoning. For instance, a lot of zones will have a maximum density that you can't go above, but very few communities will impose a minimum density. So even if their zone wants higher density, because they don't impose a minimum, they usually get less than what they plan for in that density. Bill, you had something to add?
I was going to say, I think there's, in a certain way, a more fundamental question than just the code provisions. Zoning codes sort of treat every single parcel of property as a separate universe, right? So whenever you want to build a project on a single parcel, you have to accommodate all of the possible parking that project would require as if everybody's going to drive when they go to the next parcel next door. And I think a more fundamental thing we're finding all over the country is that there's a lot of economies of scale and a lot of efficiencies on this public infrastructure of traffic capacity and parking capacity. If you can deal with it at kind of a district level or a neighborhood level, if you can create a fair amount of pool of parking, a pool of parking in a neighborhood, for example, in a business district, and you add housing, then you don't have to give everybody 3 parking spaces for every condo or for every house, because there's sufficient parking nearby. And because, of course, they're not really driving from one parcel to the next. They're walking. So I think it's not just changing the, a lot of our, it is true that a lot of our audit tools talk about changing the standards, but it's not really just changing the standards. It's changing the whole philosophy so that what you're talking about is building a whole neighborhood or building a whole community together rather than treating every single parcel of land as if it's a separate universe for zoning and planning purposes.
Does the toolkit help communities at that level or simply at the more, not simply, but...
No, it can do either, if I may interject here, Benji. It can do either, and we deliberately set up a policy audit and a code audit so that you can measure the policies against, in your general plan, say, against the principles of smart growth. You can also measure the code provisions against the principles of smart growth and against the smart growth principles if they're already embedded in your plans. So we tried to make it multiple levels, but where we found the disconnect over and over again was that there are plans out there that have wonderful policies, but the codes do not reflect what the policies are trying to achieve.
The toolkit also includes a project scorecard that helps measure the qualities of proposed development projects to see if they correspond to a community's vision for smarter growth. What qualities does it measure?
It depends on the size of the project. It can measure. It measures the housing mix. Is this project adding a new housing option to the district or to the neighborhood or within a quarter mile range? It looks at land use. Is this project adding new uses within a quarter mile range or within the neighborhood? It looks at connectivity. If it's a large enough project, is it connecting to new developments or existing development? It looks at the provision of sidewalks. It looks at the provision, the speed design of streets. So it's very, very intensive. There are, I think, 67 plus issues that it looks at for any development, and it's ranging in size from single projects to large development.
I know it's still in beta version, but are communities now using the toolkit?
Yes, we had at least 50 people download it. We opened up the site on Tuesday. It's still in beta. The site itself is in beta, but the tools are already in their release form, their version 1 form. And so we had about 50-plus people download it on the first day, and probably we'll have more as more we get out the word on the tools.
And Benjamin, I know you said the tools are in final form. You've obviously been using these tools with people around the country for the last year or two. Can you tell me about a community that's used these tools and it has led to the change? It's led to a change in the growth pattern of the community.
It's too early to say whether it's led to a change in the growth pattern of the community, but it has led to changes in the way they handle their codes and their zoning or their policies and audits. We've worked with about 18 communities over the last 4 years, so the tools have gone through a lot over the 4 years from starting off with just a list of codes and zoning to the format it is now. But in several of the communities we've worked at, one community, which I won't name, but it's a sizable city and county somewhere in the middle of the country, and what we looked at was their subdivision regulations, and what we found out through the tools were their policies were saying one thing. They had decided that all development in their city was going to follow the transect principle, which the new urbanists use, but their subdivision regulations were using a one size fits all standard, which meant that they weren't getting the projects they wanted, and whatever good projects were coming through had to be shepherded through for it to see the light of day. And one of the things that the tools does is that it makes smart growth the default, and it levels the playing field. In many of the communities we've worked at, we've seen this yearning for smart growth and wanting to do it, but what the rules they put in actually make it harder to implement smart growth. And what the tools does is it evens up that playing field. And so there's that one. And Bill, you had something
right.
else?
I was going to say, that's the fundamental idea here. You know, for many years you heard people in this field advocating for smart growth and saying it's a good thing and you should do it. And the point of this project was to take one step beyond that and say there's many, many communities in this country that like the idea, that want to do it, but need help in figuring out how to do it. And from our point of view, you know, nothing, there's no better promotion than success. And so that's why this was designed not as advocacy or telling people what they should do or telling people it's a good thing to do, but very nuts and bolts assistance to communities like the one Benji said, which was a combined city and county, where the engineering codes for the roads and stuff were exactly the same in the downtown as they were out in the country. And we found, actually, over and over again, we found that one of the biggest difficulties was that there were not different development standards for different contexts. That your development standards for the downtown were the same as in the suburbs, were the same as in the rural areas. But I think that the point is, we have tried very hard, and this was part of what EPA was trying to do in the grant, to help communities help themselves and to promote the idea by helping communities that want to do this be successful.
And Bill, once a community decides it wants to move in this direction, is it hard to retrofit the existing growth pattern?
Well, a lot of it, yes and no, and again, it all depends on the context. Frankly, one of the things we found, and I live in the West, which is a fast growth area, but one of the things we found is that, of course, if there's more development pressure and there's more growth going on, it's a little bit easier to retrofit or to change things because you've got a lot of demand to work with, right? What we found in some of the other communities which had less growth pressure was not that we went into one community, for example, which was moderate. It wasn't declining, but it had only moderate growth, and they had just adopted a general plan which was very far-reaching, and they wanted to create all these town centers and all these different districts, and we had to say to them, look, you don't have enough demand to be able to do that in the 20 years or whatever of your time frame of your plan. So you're going to have to focus more on specific areas, at the downtown and a couple other specific nodes. So it's different in different parts of the country depending on demand, but there's always development and always construction going on somewhere. And in a low demand area, you just have to focus it more. And in most communities, especially in the older parts of the country, there's just such great raw material in the older neighborhoods. If you can just find a way to reinforce it a little bit more rather than draining all of the energy out of it with 1 or 3 acre lot subdivisions.
When you say focus it a little bit more, help it along in slower growth communities, what does that mean? What do you do?
Well, that means trying to reinforce the old downtown, the old neighborhood. I grew up in upstate New York. We haven't done any projects up there, but I grew up in upstate New York, and what I see there, you know, an area that would seem to have no demand at all, very depressed, but nevertheless, there's a fair amount of construction going on there. All of the construction that goes on out in the country, as I said, in 1 to 3 acre lots, thereby draining more and more energy out of the older cities. Whereas the older cities and villages, as I say, have great raw material. They were built as smart growth communities, where people can easily walk, and if you can. And what I mean by helping them along is if you can just show, among other things, that it's more fiscally responsible, that it's easier to manage and pay for and maintain the infrastructure if you direct more growth back into the older areas, which is a huge issue in a depressed area where they are having a hard time paying for all of their infrastructure. That makes an enormous difference.
Well, it is a huge issue. And Benjamin, I'm wondering what sort of models do you use to demonstrate that it is fiscally more responsible, more efficient to develop along smart growth patterns than not?
Well, like Bill said, success is the best example, and so we show them the communities that have been doing this. The other thing is the tools ask, as far as the regulations of the community goes or as far as the thinking of the community goes, as they pursue these projects, particularly in the scorecard, whether they're considering such issues as the provision of services, whether they're already maximizing existing capacity in their networks, whether that's sewer or water or school or transportation. And the scorecard itself allocates higher ratings for projects that do that.
Mm-hmm. If you had to give our cities a grade on their progress towards smart growth, what grade would you give?
I'd actually give them about a B-. This is, you know, whereas 10 years ago I think I would have given them a D. I think our communities, and I just don't want to say cities, but our cities and villages and towns and settlements across the country, a wide variety of people, neighbors, politicians, developers, and as Benji said, retail stores have all come to recognize both the power and the efficiency of a more concentrated development pattern, which is really what smart growth is talking about. I haven't seen a part of the country where we have every single part of the country I've been to, there's been some understanding of this and some progress toward it. So I'd say about a C plus B minus at this point, which is a huge improvement over 10 years ago.
Plus, if I might add, it's also because the leadership on addressing climate change in terms of the built environment has been coming from our communities, has been coming from our cities. And there's more of a clamor and demand there because they deal with these issues with the cost of services and the cost of infrastructure and the congestion that they experience. So there's a stronger clamor there, a stronger clamor for a search for solutions.
Benjamin, would you say that, again, it's this combination of cost of service, congestion, and climate that is propelling the momentum on smart growth?
Definitely, definitely, along with the very, very big demographic change that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so changing preferences. Chris Leinberger of the Brookings Institute, who just released a report last week, always likes talking about the change in preferences. And if you look at the situation comedies in the 50s and the 60s and the situation comedies in the 90s and the early part of the century, in the 50s and 60s, it was all about being in the suburbs. Leave It to Beaver, Father Knows Best. And in the 90s and early part of the century, it's about being in the city, being in a coffee shop, Seinfeld, Friends. And so that is tracking a very, very large sea change in of a sea change, basically, in the preferences of people.
I want to thank you both for being our guest on Smart City.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Benjamin Della Pena is with the Smart Growth Leadership Institute. Bill Fulton is Senior Research Fellow at the University of Southern California. And together they developed the Smart Growth Implementation Toolkit. This week, CityView's commentator Walker Smith stresses the importance of teamwork.
A recent article in the New York Times reported that the ideal CEO of the future will be a team player. This is in contrast to the egomaniacal empire builders of the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s, and to the company fixer-uppers of recent years who followed their larger-than-life predecessors with the task of restoring value to these toppled empires. Future success will require an approach to business driven more by a shared vision than an individual dream, and by a spirit of cooperation than an unyielding will to dominate. Both market conditions and business sensibilities are at work. The global contingencies of tomorrow will require a more cooperative approach grounded in a more sensitive engagement with others. No one person can dominate when teamwork is the basic requirement for getting things done. Working effectively with others means more accommodation of their needs, feelings, and perspectives. And besides, we now live in an era in which people will no longer tolerate being bossed around. This is not just business. This is every aspect of contemporary life. The 2007 Super Bowl face-off between head coaches Tony Dungy of the Indianapolis Colts and Lovie Smith of the Chicago Bears was said to be the triumph of the nice guy. Both coaches bring a new style to their profession. The explosive, domineering coaching styles of years past, embodied in coaches like Vince Lombardi, Bear Bryant, Woody Hayes, Billy Martin, and Red Auerbach, have been eclipsed by the less overbearing, more respectful styles of coaches like Dungy and Smith. Certainly, there remain plenty of coaching tyrants, but contemporary athletes have more leverage and power than athletes of yore, and this is forcing changes in coaching styles. Success now depends upon a cooperative team-building relationship between players and coaches. The old style of bossing players around with impunity just doesn't cut it anymore. Mutual respect and civility are essential to any possibility of success in every domain of life nowadays, even in our foreign policy. It is difficult for Americans to bring a more open, compromising spirit to global security and our national interest. But just as in business and sports, unless we do, we will not succeed. We have seen this in recent entanglements around the world. And it will increasingly be true as the economies of China, India, Russia, and others start to dominate the global scene. America alone has led for so long that we have trouble imagining any other way. But we won't dominate in the future the way we have since World War I. We will be one nation and one economy among many. We won't be able to unilaterally impose our will or boss anybody around. Newly ascendant nations won't stand for it, as indeed none of them are today. Saber rattling and subversion will have to give way to cooperative team building if we are to realize our national ambitions in the future. But that's okay, because we know already from business and sports that direction is the right way to go. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.